Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare. Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare,
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna, Krishna.
So it's March 2nd, 2014, Ljubljana, Slovenia. And. Yes?
Go down to the books.
And we're going to be discussing how to deal with sexual desire. This is based on Srila Prabhupada's teachings, teachings of our acharyas. So we have four parts. We're going to be describing our original spiritual bliss. If I'm too fast, you'll tell me, right? Yes, okay. Then how that love turns into lust, how we turn the lust back into love, ultimately, and how we deal with the remaining lust and use that in Krishna's service in two ways. So first we're going to look at the original spiritual bliss. So this is the purport from the very first verse of the Bhagavatam, that everything's coming from Krishna. And there is a reality of sexual life, sexual pleasure, sexual desire in the spiritual world. And what we have in this world is simply a twisted or changed version of this origin. Now, one of the main purports in which Srila Prabhupada discusses this is quoted from here. We'll be quoting from it quite a lot. Madhulila 8, 138, where Krishna is called the original ever-fresh Cupid. And for those of us who chant the Gayatri Mantra, we have these names of Krishna indicating that he's the original Cupid. Kamadev, Pushpabanai, one who carries, van means arrow, one who carries flower arrows. Cupid has five arrows for the five senses. And Ananga, one who's without a material body. And here again is from that same purport. And Prabhupada says, in the material world, if we're sexually inclined, we enjoy something temporary that vanishes after a few minutes. Here he says, in the spiritual world, the same enjoyment is there, but it never vanishes. It's enjoyed continuously. It appears to be more and more relishable, whereas materially, sex desire becomes distasteful, and it's never permanent. So Krishna is called the new Cupid in the spiritual world, but there's no material inebriety. This means the residents of the spiritual world, they're constantly enjoying the original form of sexual pleasure, and it's always getting better and better. Material sexual pleasure we enjoy briefly, and when it's over, it's like, and it's full of immaterial inebriety. So one could think, well, that only applies to Krishna. The Prabhupada also says in that same purport that this desire for pleasure exists both in Krishna and in the jivas. So all the living entities, that means us, have the same desire for pleasure, and in our natural spiritual state, that is a spiritual desire. And here we're looking at Adi 14:29. So this Ananda Maya Vyasat, looking for pleasure, pleasure seeking. This term from the Vedanta Sutra 1.1.12 is used to describe both the Lord and us, the living entities. We are all pleasure seeking. It's something like in the military, they have weapons that seek heat, heat-seeking missiles. You've heard of that, right? They shoot the missile and it goes to the heat of the engine of the rocket or the tank and zooms right in on it. So we are all looking for pleasure. Even the scientists call this the pleasure principle. And here Prabhupada says, again, this is in 8.139 of Madhulila. Here Prabhupada says we have the same lusty desire as Krishna. And because we're all part of Krishna, because we're part of Krishna, Krishna has this desire for enjoyment, we must have this desire also. Now, this next purport is really what started me teaching this seminar. I was in New Zealand. I was just asked to give the morning Bhagavatam class. It was on this verse, 5.25.5. And after that class, the devotees begged me. They said, please make this into a regular seminar that you teach all over the world. And sometimes I taught it to the Pandavasena maybe a year or so later. And many senior devotees were there. And they said, please, you have to teach this to everyone. They said, if when people are new to Krishna consciousness, they learn this, it will save them so much grief. So what does it say in this purport? And this is in the chapter on the glories of Lord Ananta. And here, you also translate? What language are you translating into? Also Slovenian. Okay, so if I'm going too fast, you just tell me to slow down. So Prabhupada says here that when males and females touch each other's bodies, their lusty desires naturally awaken, and there are similar feelings in spiritual body. So the spiritual bodies also have these feelings, and the soul has these spiritual, the original form of this desire. And as Prabhupada says here, the spiritual form is like gold, and the material form is like iron. Now, if these desires and these feelings are present in the soul and in our spiritual bodies, then it follows that they cannot be killed. They cannot be destroyed. They're part of our self. They're part of our spiritual body. So Srila Prabhupada makes this point over and over and over.
They say that we become desireless, not as normal. Suddenly, if I become desireless, I become dead. So long I am living in duty, I must be there. I cannot change.
So this is a point Srila Prabhupada makes hundreds or thousands of times. We cannot kill desires. Although, materially speaking, our sexual desires get us into all kinds of trouble and are very embarrassing for us and are at the root of a lot of the immorality of the world, it is not possible to kill these desires. So here you see, right, we have the butterfly and the stone, and here you have the plant wrapped around the rod and the iron wrapped around the rod. If we try to kill our desires, then we're trying to become dead. We're trying to become like a stone. So the difference between a living being and matter is that a living being is full of desires. So here is in teachings of Lord Chaitanya. Now this is from the same section that 8.138 purport is from, where Prabhupada is saying, lust and the sex urge are in spiritual life. But when we are in material elements, that urge is expressed through the body and is therefore pervertedly reflected. It becomes twisted. It becomes a twisted reflection. So the material desire for sex is abominable and the spiritual desire is desirable. And we'll get into why shortly. So this means we cannot kill it. We cannot destroy something that is originally part of our spiritual nature.
The sex feelings of the human society is original. It is not unnatural, because the same sex feeling is there in the original personality of God. The pleasure potency is Srimati Radharani. That's really the attraction of sex. Loving at death on the basis of sex feeling is the original feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and we, the conditioned soul, being the part and parcel of the Supreme, we have got such feelings, but they are in a permanent, minute condition.
So any attempt to kill these feelings is simply impersonalism or voidism philosophy. Now what's the result of trying to kill these feelings that are really part of the soul? So there are three different results that are mentioned that will happen if we try to kill these feelings. So one of them is anger. Anger is called the younger brother of lust. And if we try to kill the sexual feelings, which are actually part of the soul, then we may end up simply experiencing anger. By the way, anger is one of the seven secondary rasas spiritually. And materially, everything we are doing is trying to experience these rasas. So you'll find sometimes that people who are just trying to repress or kill their sexual feelings and sexual desires become very angry. And they may get to the point that they're trying to enjoy this anger. Anger is one of the rasas, and they may go around always being angry. Another consequence is to have a hard heart. So recently one devotee confided this in me and said, I've turned off my sexual feelings, and in doing so, I've turned off a lot of other things too. So hardening the heart is very dangerous for bhakti. Bhakti requires a soft heart, a melting heart. Bhakti is full of feelings and love for Krishna. So if one tries to just kill the sexuality, it actually makes bhakti harder. And of course, one cannot permanently harden the heart. Another consequence is therefore fall down. Generally, we see people who will vacillate between these things. They'll have a hard heart, and then sometimes they'll get angry, and sometimes they may have a fall down. Fall down means that they end up succumbing to some nasty form of sexuality. So they were repressing, and then instead of, you know, having legitimate marriage, they go see a prostitute or something like that. So there's some kind of fall down. So again, we often see a cycling between this, that a person trying to kill or repress their sexuality hardens their heart, but then the heart sometimes manifests in either a fall down or anger. Other times we see people, I've seen people go on for many years, 10, 20 years, being very hard-hearted or being all the time angry. And we have this problem sometimes in our Hare Krishna movement with people who misunderstand that the way to deal with sexuality is to try to kill it. So how exactly does the spiritual sexuality manifest? I say that the Lord experiences this adiras. Adi means the first, the essential. So he experiences this adiras through his own potency called Ladini Shakti, of course, who is presided over, personified by Srimati Radharani. As explained here, that she resembles Krishna's own figure, and she's the personification of Ladini Shakti, or the pleasure potency. So this is how Krishna experiences the original spiritual form of the adiras, of spiritual sexuality, with Radharani and all of her expansions. As she expands as all the gopis, all the queens, the lakshmis, and so forth. You might say, well, how do we, the jiva, experience this adiras? Because Prabhupada's explained very thoroughly that we, the jiva, also have these desires, and that we, the jiva, also experience this pleasure in our natural state, and that we experience it continuously, right? Remember Prabhupada said that? That in the spiritual world is experienced continuously, right? And is always getting fresher and fresher. How do we experience that? So Srila Prabhupada explains that Radharani, the pleasure potency, Ladini Shanti, she's also giving pleasure to all of Krishna's devotees. She's giving Krishna's pleasure, and she's also nourishing all the devotees with that pleasure. Well, how exactly does that work? And here, Prabhupada explains, this is the essential principle. Right here is the essential principle, and this is what differentiates spiritual, the pure gold spiritual sexuality from the perverted material iron sexuality. And that is that the devotees become pleased by seeing Krishna pleased. They do not want to be pleased independently. Now, of course, Prabhupada says here that Krishna is pleased when he sees the devotees are pleased. That's love. Isn't that how we understand love? That I'm happy by the happiness of the person I love? Any kind of love, right? If I have a friend, how do you know that I'm your friend? That I'm happy when you're happy? How do I know someone's my friend? They're happy when I'm happy. Isn't that what we call love? Yes? That someone else's happiness is sufficient for my happiness? So I remember my daughter studied Bharatanatyam dance from when she was very young, 6, 7. And finally, when she was an adult, she got to have what's called her arangecham, like your graduation ceremony. It was a big deal. It was actually a much bigger deal than her wedding. And then we had to fly in the musicians, and it was a whole thing. We had to rent a hall. And she had been practicing every day for months and months, because when you do this arangecham, you have to dance for about like 6 or 8 hours, just yourself. And it's very intense. And I remember when she first went up on the stage and started, I felt so happy that she was happy. I felt overwhelmingly happy. Oh, now someone I love is achieving her desire. So we've all experienced this, yes? That somebody that we love, they have something wonderful happen, and we experience that as becomes our happiness. Our happiness is their happiness. So that is how the jiva experiences this adiras. This is a very important thing to understand. This is the natural way the jiva experiences this unlimited, ever-increasing, constant spiritual form of sexual pleasure, is by seeing Krishna happy. And Krishna wants to see the living entities happy. And Prabhupada says this is the aim of our Krishna consciousness movement. It is for all of us to be participating in this pleasure of Krishna with his consorts. And here again, Prabhupada explains it so many places. Our spiritual pleasure is when we are trying to please Krishna. We are designed to get pleasure indirectly. That's how we are designed. We are not designed to enjoy pleasure directly. The example of Srila Prabhupada often gives, what are some examples Prabhupada gives? How are we designed to enjoy? What are two analogies that he gives? Nobody has any idea.
Like if you give food to the stomach.
Yes, there you go. Exactly. Prabhupada says you give food to the stomach, then... Exactly, thank you. That you water the root of the tree. We're like the little leaves on the tree. But you don't pour water on the leaves, you pour water on the root. And if the hand wants to be happy, the hand doesn't take the food and rub it into itself. The hand puts the food in the stomach, and then the hand becomes happy. When we were meeting with Prabhupada in 1976, he said, if you put food in your stomach, good food, you will get good eyesight. But if you put the food in your eyes, you'll become blind. Okay? So this is how we are meant to experience this adiras, this unlimited, ever-expanding spiritual form of sexual pleasure. So what does this mean? What does it mean that when we please the Lord? What does it mean to please the Lord? Please means pleasure. And who is the energy of pleasure? Radharani, all of the gopis. When we unite Krishna and Radharani, that is pleasing Krishna. And pleasing Krishna is uniting Krishna with his pleasure energy. Whenever we say, I should try to please Krishna, I want to please Krishna, do this to please Krishna, what do we mean by that? We mean, I am bringing together Krishna and his energy of pleasure. Does that make sense to everybody? I'm trying to please Krishna. That means I am uniting Krishna with his pleasure energy, and then I also experience pleasure. I mean, in this world, we have some idea of that, right? If you introduce somebody to their future husband, future wife, then you also feel happy, yes? You go to the wedding of your friends, and then you also feel happy. So they want, when people have a wedding, when people get married, usually, not always, but usually they invite many guests because they want to share their happiness with their friends. And then as the friends and family, we feel happy at their happiness. So it's very much something like that. And here's Bhaktivinoda Thakur speaking how he wants to unite Radha and Krishna. So this is the essence of how the jiva experiences this pleasure.
Radha Krishna,
everyone in Goloka Vrindavan is trying to unite Radha and Krishna. Everyone. This is not only applicable to the gopis. We may think, well, the gopis, they're engaged in the Sadi Rash. What about the cowherd boys and the cows and the blades of grass and the flowers? But all the living entities, all the pure living entities in the spiritual world, they're engaged in enhancing this relationship between Radha and Krishna. Even the apparent antagonists, Radharani's mother-in-law and so forth, they're really facilitating this exchange of love between Radha and Krishna. Now, this doesn't only apply to Radha and Krishna. It applies also in Vaikuntha. The way the residents of Vaikuntha are experiencing this happiness is by wanting to engage Lakshmi in the service of Narayana. And you can understand, in this world, what does Lakshmi mean? Lakshmi means the six opulences: wealth, strength, fame, knowledge, beauty, and renunciation. Generally, in this world, we want to enjoy those opulences, but when we engage them in the service of the Lord for His pleasure, then we start to experience this original Adi Ras. And this is true, of course, also with Sita and Ram. And here's the example of Hanuman. So again, this is another example that this pleasure is enjoyed by all of the pure devotees, not only those in Goloka, not only those who are gopis, but all of the pure devotees in any relationship with Krishna or in any relationship with any incarnation of Krishna. So like Hanuman, he's getting his happiness from uniting Sita and Ram. To a somewhat lesser extent, this is true even for the happiness achieved by impersonal realization. So Jiva Goswami explains about the pranava mantra Omkara. So Omkara, as you know, is made up of O and M. Right? O and M. Now in Sanskrit, whenever you have two vowels together, they join to form a new sound. So this is true even in English. If we have the English word cream, C-R-E-A-M, so the letters E and A join together to make the sound E. But in English, it's not logical, because E by itself says E, and A by itself says A. So it's not that you have E-A-A-A-A, it doesn't make E. But in Sanskrit, the language is in perfect harmony with biology. So in Sanskrit, the sound O comes from the sound A and U. And if you put together A, U, A, U, A, U, A, U, A, you end up saying O. So this sound A, this is the most basic sound, a sound you make without the lips or the tongue or the teeth, A, A. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, I am the sound A. Now, when we read it in translation, it may look like Krishna saying he's the letter A, but it's not the English letter A. He's the sound A. And Jiva Goswami explains Radharani is the letter U, and then we, the living entities, are the Anushwar and the letter M. So this A, U, M is Krishna, his pleasure energy, and ourselves. And therefore, even those chanting Omkara, the happiness they get is that they are uniting Krishna with this energy of pleasure. Of course, you know where is the main place we do this in our Hare Krishna movement. So what are we doing? When we are chanting Hare Krishna, we are uniting Krishna with His pleasure energy. Hare Krishna, Hare Rama. You might say, well, where are we in the Hare Krishna mantra? The Hare Krishna mantra is in what we call the vocative. Vocative is a way of speaking to somebody. So in Sanskrit, like, my name is Urmila, but if you're going to speak to me in Sanskrit, you wouldn't say, oh, Urmila, would you like some water? You'd say, oh, Urmile, would you like some water? The form of the name changes. So this form of Hare, Krishna, and Rama are the forms used when you're talking to someone. They're not used any other time. So as soon as those forms are used, somebody has to be talking. And of course, that person talking is us. So therefore, we are also included in this Hare Krishna mantra. And if one chants this Hare Krishna mantra with affection and with a desire to please Krishna, then one starts to feel the spiritual form of sexual pleasure. And as Prabhupada says, you like that? As Prabhupada says, that when we chant Hare Krishna, that Radha and Krishna are dancing on our tongue. We are basically, what is the service we're doing when we're chanting Hare Krishna? We're providing the ground, just like we're singing in the morning for the spiritual master, Nikunja Yunurati Keli Siddhai Yayali Bir Yuktira Bhakshaniya Tatraji Daksha Rati Balabas, that the spiritual master is making many arrangements to bring together Radha and Krishna. So when we chant Hare Krishna, we're making our body the meeting place. You understand? We're making our tongue and our heart becomes the meeting place for Radha and Krishna. Therefore, Prabhupada says chanting Hare Krishna means you make a diamond throne in your heart, and you have Krishna sitting there, and you bathe him with Ganga and Jamuna water, and you decorate him. So this is the idea of chanting Hare Krishna. Okay, so now we've looked at what is the original spiritual form of sexual desire and sexual pleasure. And now we're going to look at what is the meaning of the mess that we're in, of our material sexuality. So you remember that Hanuman has this desire to unite Sita and Ram. That Hanuman is getting his happiness from uniting Sita and Ram. That is spiritual sexual enjoyment. Material sexuality is I want to be Krishna and I want to enjoy Radharani separately. Or Ravana, here we have Ravana kidnapping Sita and fighting with Jatayu. So Ravana's idea is I want to enjoy Sita. I want to enjoy the pleasure energy. I want to be the enjoyer and I want to enjoy the pleasure energy separately from Krishna. Instead of facilitating Krishna's pleasure, I want to take it from Krishna and enjoy independently. This is called stealing. Yes? Stealing. And, of course, this pleasure energy is all the opulences. Whenever we want to enjoy wealth, strength, fame, knowledge, beauty, or renunciation, separately from Krishna. So and, of course, the ultimate expression of this is in sexuality, material sexuality, where I'm trying to enjoy separately from Krishna, either in a male form, with enjoying some woman, hoping the woman is an expansion of Radharani, or in a female form, trying to be the expansion of Radharani, trying to enjoy as my own body. So either way, I'm trying to enjoy separately from Krishna. And this really doesn't satisfy us, causes us all kinds of trouble, and shackles us to an illusion. It shackles us to an illusion that I am separate from Krishna and that I have the capacity to enjoy separately from Krishna. And that's the illusion that it shackles us to. So we had this quote before, and that when the spiritual urge, Prabhupada says, is expressed through the material body, it's pervertedly reflected. So it's a spiritual urge, it's a spiritual desire, it's a spiritual experience, but when it comes out through a material body, it's twisted. Does that mean that the problem is the body? That if you just got rid of the body, that everything would be fine? No. No. It's not that the body is causing the twisting. It's that the twisting is causing the body. As Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita 15:9, that our body, our senses, the particular body we have, is based around our mind. That basically, because we have this desire to try to enjoy this happiness separately from Krishna. Therefore, we get a body. So it's not that, you know, I'm pure and my body is forcing me to have a twisted material form of this desire, but because I have a twisted form of this desire, therefore I get a body with which to express this twisted form. Is that clear to everybody? Okay, the body is a vehicle, a machine, that allows me, because Krishna is eko bahunam yovadadati kaman, Krishna is fulfilling our desires. So when I have this desire to enjoy separately from Krishna, which actually I can't really enjoy separately from Krishna, but Krishna facilitates it by giving me an illusion that I have this body. Now, what's really interesting is that the material form of sexuality can often be confused as something spiritual. So it's sometimes hard to tell the difference. And this fact of the confusion is apparent with Krishna's son, Prajumna. So Krishna's son, Prajumna, is the material Cupid. Krishna himself is a spiritual Cupid. But Krishna's son, Prajumna, is the material Cupid. And Krishna's son, Prajumna, looks so much like Krishna that his own stepmothers thought that he was Krishna at first. They couldn't tell the difference between Prajumna and Krishna. So Prajumna looked so much like Krishna, he was confused even by his mothers. So we can become confused. We can think that spiritual sexuality is material and material sexuality is spiritual, even though they're really quite different. Okay, so that's the problem. And the real essence of the difference is in spiritual sexuality, my pleasure is in giving pleasure to Krishna. And in material sexuality, my pleasure is in taking pleasure from Krishna and trying to enjoy it myself independently of him. It's just really, 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 really simple. It's really simple. It's just like if you have a very good friend and they have a beautiful home and they invite you to dinner and you have a wonderful dinner and you're enjoying with them. Or if you sneak into the person's house at night and you steal their money and you steal their food and you take it home and you try to enjoy it separately. It's the same money, it's the same food, but when you enjoy it with your friend, that's real enjoyment. If you steal it from your friend and try to enjoy it separately, that's false enjoyment. Is that clear to everybody? This is the essential difference between spiritual sexual desire and sexual pleasure and material sexual desire and sexual pleasure. One is giving and loving, and one is exploitive and taking. So what's our cure? What's our cure? How do we take this material lust, which embarrasses us, which degrades us, which sometimes causes us to do things that we really regret, that puts us into so many difficult situations? How do we turn this back into the beautiful, pristine thing? So we have to take our desires and not kill them, but turn them to pleasing Krishna. Prabhupada says again here, we cannot kill desires. Right? This is such a big point, right? We cannot kill desires. We have to purify them. If our desires are applied to the service of the Lord, they become purified. This is Bhagavatam 4:22-30. We have to start changing our desires, that instead of trying to get my happiness directly, I'm going to get my happiness by pleasing Krishna.
Kama Krishna Paramatmane. At the present moment we are desiring, how to become happy in this material world. This is Kama. So this brain taxation, if you engage in Krishna service, how to spread Krishna consciousness, how to convince people about Krishna, how to take them to the Krishna
So it's a transformation of how to make Krishna happy. Of course, it's very possible to think about spreading Krishna consciousness still with the desire to make me happy. I can think, well, I want to spread Krishna consciousness, so everybody will say to me, oh, how wonderful you are. You've distributed 1,000 books, all glories to you. But the idea is to take the same, as Prabhupada said, brain taxation, the same effort and same energy, and think of how to please Krishna. And one does that with absorption in the Lord. Mam anusmaram yujit cha. So Krishna says this right after he says, yam yam vapi smaram bhavam. Right after Krishna says, whatever we think about at the time of death is where we go. Then Krishna says, therefore think of me while you do all your activities. And Krishna is telling Arjuna, think of me while you fight. So that's pretty hard. When you're fighting, you're going to have real concentration of mind, because people are trying to kill you. It's going to be pretty intense. And still Krishna says, Mama Nusmaram Yujicha, think of me while you fight. And how? Maya Shaktamana Partha. This is Bhagavad Gita 7.1, the most often quoted verse that Srila Prabhupada quoted. Think of me with attachment. With attachment. Attachment. We get attached to anything or anyone that we are convinced will make us happy and will give us fulfillment and will satisfy our needs. That's our definition of attachment. Right? Does that make sense? Like, I have some attachment to this computer because it facilitates the service that I do. I have attachment to these glasses because they facilitate me being able to see. So we become attached to Krishna when we understand that Krishna is really the one who's fulfilling all of my desires, satisfying all of my needs. It's by Krishna that I'll become happy. Now, at first, that attachment to Krishna is still self-centered. Krishna will make me happy. Therefore, I become attached to Krishna. But gradually, that attachment to Krishna becomes, how can I make Krishna happy? Because when we make Krishna happy, we're automatically happy, and we forget about our own happiness. And one has to get the real experience. One has to get the real experience. Pratyaksha bhagamam dharmam susukham kartamabhyam. Pratyaksha means experience. Susukham, very, very, very happy. This is where Krishna is talking about what is religion, the secret religion. Raja vidya, raja guhyam. Guhyam means secret. You have to experience it. If you just come to the Hare Krishna movement and you study the philosophy so that you know the philosophy and you can pass an exam. Okay, yes, Krishna has internal, external, and marginal potencies, and they're called, this is their Sanskrit names, and this is the list of the 10 offenses, and this is the different Purusha avatars, and you can write that on an exam, and you can repeat it back. And you know how to ring the bell with your left hand and move the incense with your right hand without doing this, right? You know, just figuring out that kind of stuff, you know, figuring out the particular rituals we do, figuring out how to say, please accept my obeisances, you know, learning the little Sanskrit terms and all that kind of stuff. That's not really what's going to do it. I mean, that's good. We should do that. But our idea is to get the experience. We need to be getting the experience. We need to be experiencing this spiritual ecstasy. Because remember, we're pleasure-seeking. We are pleasure-seeking. If we are not experiencing the spiritual taste, then we will go for the material taste. We are not able to live without pleasure. We can't do it. You can't do it. You can do it for a while and harden your heart so that you have no pleasure. But even then, you're getting pleasure from something. Maybe then we're getting pleasure from the ghastly rasa. There's also a ghastly rasa. Not like people who watch horror movies. They're enjoying this ghastly rasa. Prabhupada said if you really want to enjoy the ghastly rasa, you should worship. Who? No. The Singhadev. He's wearing a garland of intestines and grabbing out Hiranyakashipu's heart. That's pretty ghastly. Of course, Krishna does some ghastly things too. He fights with Jarasandha. He makes a river of blood, and there's human and animal parts floating in the river. That's pretty ghastly. So when people try to have no enjoyment, when people try to kill both spiritual and material enjoyment, They end up enjoying something because we're in Anandamaya Vyasa. So they may end up trying to enjoy the ghastly rasa. Oh, material life is just terrible. Ah, it's all disgusting, horrible. And that's their enjoyment. or they may be enjoying anger. Last time I taught the seminar, someone came up to me afterwards and said, yes, we have one devotee here in our temple who's always angry. Oh, Hare Krishna. So one has to experience the real spiritual thing. Otherwise, we will try to experience the material thing, either directly as sexual lust, or indirectly as anger, or indirectly as ghastliness. We will not be able to live without trying to experience pleasure. That is not possible. Please don't try to do that. It's just not possible. It will not happen. It will not work. It will not work. So if we want to experience the spiritual thing, then we have to experience the spiritual thing. There's just no alternative. There's no alternative. If we want to give up the lust, if we want to give up the pleasure of stealing our friends' money and food and eating it secretly in our house, then we have to start experiencing the pleasure of enjoying our friends' money and food with them. Now, you may make the argument, okay, Amila, that's great. That's great. I agree with that. I appreciate that. I know all about that. But it's not happening 100% right now. It's gradual. Okay? I'm getting some happiness on the spiritual platform sometimes, but I'm not yet feeling totally spiritually happy all the time. So what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I still have the material lust. So the way I think of it is like we have this big pile of material lust, right? Really tall pile, and our spiritual love is a very little pile. So this is explained nicely in Madhurya Kadambini, where Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur talks about how when we start out in spiritual life, we have a little speck of love for Krishna that becomes a trace. And as our love for Krishna increases, our material desires decrease, our self-absorption decreases. Now, it's quite important, and I can't emphasize this enough, do not think that first I'm going to lose the material desire and then I'm going to increase the spiritual desire. That is not bhakti. That's other processes. The way that we decrease the material desire is by increasing the spiritual desire. Prabhupada says gradual and proportional. As I proportionately increase the spiritual desire, my material desire goes down to the same by the same amount. And as I say, if you read Madhurya Kadambini, it's very nicely explained there. We have some nice charts on Madhurya Kadambini that show this effect. Now, what's even more fascinating is when you get halfway, Prabhupada says, when you get 50% that the material desires are gone and 50% a desire to please Krishna, at that point, you enter into a stage called nishta, or steadiness. At this point, the modes of passion, ignorance, they're still there, but they don't really bother you very much. And at this point, material sexual desire, although it's still half there, is not really much of an impediment anymore. And Prabhupada says, to get to this stage, to get from 0 to 50%, is a hard struggle with determination. And after that, he says, everything happens very naturally and easily. So one of our goals in the Hare Krishna movement for our members should be to get to this 50% platform as quickly as possible. Because until you're at that point, Prabhupada says, it's a hard struggle with determination. Because there's so much of this lust that it's hard to deal with. But we have, depending on how much love we have for Krishna, we have some degree of material lust. What are we going to do with it? We're turning it back into the spiritual, yes, but there's some part that hasn't turned back yet. There's some part that's still twisted. What do we do with it? So this is a very important question, and this is a question that I see causes a lot of misunderstanding and difficulty for our spiritual practitioners. Because, again, we cannot kill it. You cannot take whatever is left on the material side and kill it or repress it. So what do you do with it? What do you do with it? So here Narada Muni gives the instruction. He said, does not a thing, when applied therapeutically, cure a disease that is caused by that very same thing? So this means that while we're turning the lust back into love, we have this remaining lust, and we use that remaining lust, whatever remains, we use it therapeutically. We use it differently.
This is the essence of Krishna consciousness movement. The need is the cause of the dysentery, but the same means, when it is medically treated, can cure.
This is our essence. We take this lust and we use it in a particular way so that it no longer causes us trouble and that it helps with curing the problem. So Krishna is extremely kind. Krishna is extremely kind. If you stole my money, I would not want you to enjoy it. Right? If you stole my money, I'd want that money to bring you nothing but misery. But Krishna's not like that. When we try to steal Krishna's energy and enjoy it independently, Krishna still has some pleasure in it for us. Now that is really non-envious, isn't it? That is really non-envious. We're envious of Krishna. We want to take Krishna's pleasure energy and enjoy it ourselves. And Krishna says, okay, I'll infuse that with some pleasure. Isn't that amazing? It's really amazing. Really amazing. The fact that there's any pleasure at all in material sexuality is really amazing. But Krishna is not only very kind, he's also very smart. So, I don't know if you ever wonder about these things. I'm kind of a strange person, and I am very curious about all sorts of things. And I wondered for a very long time, why is sexuality and reproduction linked? Why? I mean, in its original form in the spiritual world, there is no reproduction. There's no birth. There's no babies being born. So why is it a fact that sexual pleasure and reproduction is linked? I mean, you could have babies formed in another way. People could have sexual pleasure, and babies could be produced somehow, some other way. And in fact, we have this example that Prabhupada gives, that Vishwamitra Muni, that he created people growing on trees. No sexuality. And Lord Brahma told him to stop. He said, you're going to cause a disturbance in the universe if you do this. Please stop. So, now why did Krishna do this? Because he's so smart. He said, okay, here's the ultimate manifestation of our envy of Krishna, our wanting to enjoy separately from Krishna. The ultimate manifestation of that is our material sexuality. And when you link sex with children, you automatically have to become responsible. You must become responsible. There's just no other option. You must be responsible and you must engage in sacrifice. You basically have two forms of sacrifice available: the sacrifice of celibacy or the sacrifice of being a parent. Does that make sense to everybody? Now, in modern society, they try to break this link. They say, we want the sexual pleasure without responsibility. They're very clear. They're saying, we want our sexual pleasure over here and our children over here. We want to have complete control over whether or not we have children. We want people to be able to enjoy sexuality in whatever way they want. I don't want to be too specific, but we want people to be able to enjoy sexuality whatever way they want. And if they want to have children, you know, then they can try to have children. But we don't want to say that sexual enjoyment must lead to children. They're breaking this link and causing havoc in society because of that. This is the bewilderment of the conditioned soul in this age, because it's in this sacrifice that one finds God. Krishna says, Sarva Gita Brahma. Sarva means all. Gita means staying. Brahman is God. Nitya, eternally, yajna, sacrifice. Pratishthitam is staying. So God's everywhere, and God's full of joy. How are you going to find God? How we find God? Wherever there's sacrifice, there you find God. That God, the all-joyful, is always to be found in sacrifice. Krishna also says to Brahma, tapasa ridayam sakshat atmaham tapasa. Tapasa means austerity. Tapasa ridayam sakshat. Rida means heart, sakshat means directly. So Krishna says, austerity is my very heart. Atmaham, atma means self, aham means I. My very self. Krishna says, austerity is my very self. God is joyful, but yet austerity is his heart and soul. He can be found in sacrifice. What does that mean? What is our greatest joy? Our greatest joy is love. What is love? Love is sacrifice, isn't it? There's no meaning to love without sacrifice. How do you know somebody loves you? What's your evidence that somebody loves you? That they say, oh, I love you? That they sacrifice for you, isn't it? If somebody doesn't sacrifice for you, do they love you? No. They're using you. And this is true whatever kind of love it is. Not only romantic love. Anyone who says, I love you. The evidence for that is sacrifice. Please listen very carefully. So the lowest kind of materialists, those in the mode of ignorance, they think, okay, let me get the pleasure without sacrifice. Let me break this link between sexuality and reproduction. And then their pleasure turns into sacrifice. In the modern age, when people don't get married anymore, or if they get married very late, and while they're waiting to get married, they have so many affairs. Or where, people stay single, but they make a lot of money just for their own enjoyment. They don't maintain a family with that money. Where people try to get pleasure without sacrifice, everything becomes sacrifice. The relationships become painful, the society becomes painful. Everything becomes full of sacrifice. They don't really get much pleasure at all. The next highest level in the mode of passion, one understands if I want to get enjoyment, I have to sacrifice. If I want to enjoy sexuality, I have to marry, I have to have children, I have to give charity to the society. So those people have mixed happiness and distress. The people in the mode of ignorance have only distress. Everything turns into sacrifice. In the mode of passion, they enjoy their pleasure, but their sacrifice is painful. So someone in the mode of passion, they're working hard for their enjoyment, their hard work is painful, and their enjoyment is enjoyment. Somebody in the mode of goodness understands that no, I shouldn't be trying to enjoy. I should be sacrificing for my purification. And of course, in transcendence, one does that sacrifice directly for Krishna. And then as Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita 4:24, when one sacrifices for Krishna, everything becomes transcendent. When one sacrifices for Krishna or for purification, the sacrifice becomes pleasure. The pleasure is pleasure, and the sacrifice is pleasure. So we've experienced when we cook for Krishna, that cooking for Krishna is as pleasurable as eating for Krishna. Isn't it? Have we all this experience? The sacrifice and the pleasure become one. It all becomes pleasure. Again, even materially, if I sacrifice for someone I love, that sacrifice itself is a pleasure. Even on a material level, if I want to make a nice party for someone I love, and I work hard, and I spend my money, and I decorate the house, and I make a cake, that sacrifice is just as pleasurable as the party, if there's love. So the people in the mode of ignorance are really foolish. They think, let me get the pleasure without sacrifice. Then they get only sacrifice. The people in the mode of passion are a little smarter. It's just like, right, in ignorance, like stealing, right? I don't want to work anymore. I'm just going to steal. But then the money brings them only suffering. They're always worried, when will I get caught, right? It doesn't bring them any happiness at all. If you earn your money honestly, at least you can enjoy the money, although you also have to suffer with the hard work. But in the mode of goodness or in transcendence, one not only earns one money honestly, but the process of earning it is dedicated to Krishna. And so the process of working for pleasure and the pleasure itself are both pleasure. If we really want to have pleasure without sacrifice, therefore, then we sacrifice for Krishna willingly and lovingly. And then there is no demarcation between pleasure and sacrifice, because Krishna himself is sacrifice. And of course, Krishna says in the 9th chapter that he's the butter and the fire and the offering, if we're going to talk about a sacrifice. He's the butter and the fire and the offering. And here we have this verse I was talking about. Brahmarpanam Brahmahavir, Brahmabhino Brahmanahutam, Brahmaiva Tenagantabhyam, Brahma Karma Sanadita. And as Prabhupada says in the purport to that verse, that when we use matter in the service of the Lord, it regains its spiritual quality. What this means, my dear friends, okay, so we have all this lust, we're starting to get some love, we still have this lust. If I can use this lust in sacrifice, it becomes spiritual. Isn't that cool? I mean, I just think that is so cool. I just think Krishna is amazing. I really think Krishna is amazing. He's taking this thing, which is the epitome of our envy of him, he's making it pleasurable, and he's giving us a way to use it in sacrifice so it becomes spiritualized. So this part is actual spirit, and this part can be spiritualized. Which is a little different, but the effect is the same. Like Prabhupada says, the iron rod put into the fire acts like fire. So here's the fire, and here's the iron, but we can put it in the fire. So in order to understand how to use our sexual energy, our sexual desires, in sacrifice, we need to break down the sexual desire and find out what it is. We need to analyze it. So what is it? It's a desire for connection. For yoga, we want to connect the man to the woman, the man, the woman, and the child. We're looking for a connection, for some kind of union, for yoga. Of course, we're looking for pleasure. We're looking for creation. Sex creates babies, but it also creates love and affection between the partners. And we're looking for life. In sex, people feel very alive, and again, you're creating the life of the baby. And we're also looking for vitality. For virya, and here's my little evidence, that virya or vitality is also a component of sexual energy. Here virya is called the sex energy of the Supreme Lord. This sense of strength and health and being alive. So these are the really, maybe there's more, but this is what I've analyzed as the components of sexual desire and sexual pleasure. Wanting connection, pleasure, creation, life, and vitality. Are those all good things, my dear friends? Are those all good things? Are those worthy things to want? Are those all things that we can use in sacrifice? What do you say? Can they? Yes? Yes? You're all sleeping? All right. Now we're going to look at two ways to do this. Two ways to spiritualize that remaining lust and use it in sacrifice. And I'd like to look at renounced life first, because I see that most devotees have a very peculiar idea of renounced life. Most devotees think that those engaged in renounced life either have no material sexual desires. Is that true? Is it true that all of our members who are in the Brahmachari Vanaprastha or Sannyas Ashram are completely free from material sex desire? Is that true? No. It's not that just because you're a brahmachari, vanaprastha, or sannyasi that you're a prema. Pretty easy way to get to prema. I just wear saffron and move into the brahmachari ashram and poof, you know, you've got prema and no material desires. It's not true. Or people think that the renunciates are killing their sexual desires. Have I already at least demonstrated that that is not possible? Or anybody still not convinced? Can we kill sexual desire? No. So a real renunciate, they're not necessarily free from sexual desire. Not necessarily just 100% prema. And they can't kill it. What are they doing with it? So this we can understand a little bit from Ayurveda. On a biological level, the sexual reproductive fluid in the body is the most distilled form of the life energy. And we talked about how sexuality is also virya, or energy. So Prabhupada makes some reference to this. And what is the renunciate supposed to do biologically and psychologically with the sexual energy? They're supposed to bring it up. They're supposed to bring it up. Urdhvam. Urdhvam means up. They're supposed to keep it on the brain. Ojas and tejas. When one brings this energy to the brain, one gets ojas, or effulgence, and one gets tejas, or power. I mean, after all, on a biological level, the reproductive fluid is very powerful. It's meant to produce the body of a child. It has a lot of power in it. Just like with plants, we often eat the seeds, yes? That's what grains are. Grains are the seeds of the plant. It's got the packed nutrition of the plant because it's designed to produce it in the plant. So the renunciate brings this energy to the brain. And then they become a walking sacrifice. Why are we talking about sacrifice? So here, it says in the Bhagavatam that the renunciate, the vanaprastha, did I exhaust you? Am I? Just tell me if I'm going too fast. Okay. Boy, I'm trying to talk so slowly. I'm like talking at 1/3. My normal speed is something like this, you know, and that's the way I normally talk. So I'm trying. But I was still too fast, huh? I'm so sorry. Okay, can you keep up with me? If I'm too fast, please, just tell me. Don't feel tired. I can talk even more slowly if you want. The problem with talking very slowly is that those people who speak English will all fall asleep. You know? It's like, okay, we're talking very slowly. So here we see in the Bhagavatam, the renunciates are supposed to themselves become the fire of sacrifice. The vanaprastha is supposed to use garments colored like fire. The saffron color is the color of the sacrificial fire. And also explained in the Bhagavatam that entering the renounced ashram, you take the fire of sacrifice and put it within oneself. Right? So one is in one's own body, one is this fire of sacrifice. So remember again, Krishna said, I am the butter, the fire, and the offering, right? So now we have the fire. Make your own self the fire. Now when you put butter into fire, it becomes ghee. Ghee is lovely. Do we like ghee? Yes. So the renunciate takes the butter of their sexuality, their sexual energy, they put it into the fire of their own brain, and they end up with ghee. What is their ghee? What's the ghee for the brahmachari, the vanaprastha, and the sannyasi? So one of the ghee is that they see the whole world as family. Prabhupada says here that the renunciate is not narrowing their activities, they're broadening it. An ordinary person has affection for the family. The renunciate gives that same love and care and affection, the connection to the world. the same connection they give to the world. And they also use this energy in study and in preaching. It's a creative energy. One uses this energy creatively in helping all the people of the world and in understanding the scriptures. And if you think about renunciates, you know, in the Hare Krishna movement, who are very happy, they're not trying to relish this anger ras or this ghastly ras. They're happy, balanced people who are exuding spiritual energy, creativity, vitality, connection. You'll find they're using the energy in this way. And one who wants to be a renunciate needs to, first of all, not have a whole lot of this energy, okay? So, because somebody wrote me recently and they said, why can't I do this? And if you've got a whole lot of this energy, trying to bring it up and use it in this way is going to be extremely difficult. Therefore, renunciation is generally for someone who's quite young. Brahmacharya life is for a student. Traditionally, Brahmacharya life was for children and early teenagers, and people traditionally were getting married before they were 20. Both men and women, Prabhupada talks about that the oldest a man should marry is 24. So the traditional Brahmachari was using this energy and study and creativity for a very brief time, and then they married. And then a person is again using this energy going upward at the end of life. So after they've gone through marriage, they're 50 years old, and they've been engaging in bhakti their whole life. If a person's been engaging in bhakti their whole life and gone through the grihastha ashram, then there isn't a whole lot of this left by that time. You follow? You understand? They've already turned most of it into bhakti. They've already used it, as we'll talk about in a minute, in the grihastha ashram. So there isn't a whole lot left to engage, and this they can easily bring up. So if a person finds that they're really struggling, most people, like way over 90% of people, cannot use this energy in renounced life between the ages of like 15, 20, and 50, 55. They just can't. They've got too much of it, and it's too overwhelming. So it's not for everyone. Is that pretty clear? Right? So one in the renounced ashram has to be aware of the remaining portion of this material aspect of this energy within them, and has to consciously and purposely use it in preaching and study and benefiting the world. They have to do this quite intentionally. Otherwise, there is a big risk of trying to kill it. And at the same time, such a person, of course, like everyone, should be very intensely trying to turn the lust back into love. So being able to use this energy in a renounced ashram is generally for people who haven't yet entered the youthful portion of life in full force, and people who have passed the youthful portion of life. It's generally for people in one of those two categories, and it's for people who at the end of life they've already changed most of this energy into its pure form. If people try to do this in the middle portion of life without being quite advanced in bhakti, they end up going to anger, fall down, ghastliness, hard-heartedness, etc. All right, how is it used in married life? How is this energy used in married life? Again, to keep this connection between children, responsibility, and sacrifice. So marriage is also, of course, a yajna. It is a sacrifice. And Krishna says that in gross sex, in married life, that one can see him. Prabhupada says, even in sex, one can see Krishna. So one can use it in the renounced order, one's bringing this energy up. In the married life, one is bringing this energy down. One is bringing this energy down to produce nice children as a sacrifice for Krishna. Right? Prabhupada says it is a yajna, and he compares it to eating Krishna prasadam. Now we eat Krishna prasadam, there's no sin, and we're offering as a sacrifice. So in gross sexual connection between husband and wife, both the man and the woman, they're sacrificing their body to Krishna. That Krishna, I'm going to use this body in your service by producing a nice child, or at least trying to produce a nice child, that I will then do my best to train as your devotee. And I will sacrifice my body for the care and love and affection of my spouse, of my partner, to please you, not to please the spouse directly, please, but to please Krishna. Don't try to please your spouse directly. That will be very frustrating. But one should try to please the spouse to please Krishna. One should not raise the children to get the pleasure of raising the children. Again, that will be very frustrating. But one should raise the children to please Krishna. That is sacrifice, and it's just like the sacrifice of eating prasadam. Just like that sacrifice. So the act of cooking becomes pleasurable, and the act of eating also becomes pleasurable. So husband and wife, in their bodily sexual union, they're enjoying the bodily pleasure, the emotional pleasure, and the spiritual pleasure of offering everything to Krishna. So, of course, there's not only gross sex between husband and wife, but there's the emotional connection. Again, if one tries to enjoy this separately from Krishna, one will find it quite frustrating. But if one it takes good care of the wife, takes good care of the husband, so Krishna will be happy, then one will experience this reciprocation of service and love between husband and wife. So this is on the subtle platform that one is offering this energy in sacrifice. So here we have this butter, fire, and ghee. Prabhupada often compares the man to the butter and the woman to the fire. So if in the renounced ashram, the renunciate has the fire in their own body, they're offering the butter into their own brain, their own body, here the woman is considered the sacrifice, and the man is offering the butter into the sacrifice of the woman. Now, of course, if you just take butter and you put it on a fire, what will you get? If you just take a chunk of butter and stick it on top of some fire, you're going to get a mess.
Melts.
Huh?
It melts.
You're going to get a mess all over the place, right? Right? Yes? Yes?
Yes.
Everybody still awake? Okay, so if I want to make ghee, I have to have a pot. Does this make sense to everybody? I have to put the butter inside a pot. So what's the pot? The pot is marriage. Now, you see, if you keep this link between sex and children, if you don't break this link with unnatural practices and chemicals and devices, if you keep this link, and if people are trained naturally, then the woman will demand this pot. So, generally speaking, men are much more attracted to women than women are attracted to men, yes? Generally? Yes. Men are much more uncontrollably attracted to women than women are not so uncontrollably attracted to men. Correct? Am I correct? Yes, it's very true. And the men's attraction is very quick. It's very quick, very uncontrollable, very intense. Women's attraction is not like that. Women's attraction is very slow. Why? Because the women have the babies. And so the women have to be able to say no. If the women were as uncontrollable, they couldn't say no. Women can say no. And women are slower. They say, you want me? You have to marry me. If you have a society where sex and reproduction is linked, then women will say that. Because if the woman raises a child alone, it's a big burden for her. So if a woman is raised normally, if you keep this link, then the women will say, I want my sexual partner to be a responsible, caring, competent person who's going to stay around and take care of me and take care of the children. So again, because you have this link between sex and children, it pushes sacrifice and dharma, even for atheists. Isn't that interesting? Even if you're an atheist, even if you hate God, if you keep this link between sex and children, then even materialists are pushed to dharma. Because the man goes to the woman, I want you. And she says, stop. Marry me first. Okay? Is this clear to everybody? That's how it works. Now, in modern society, they've tried to destroy this. They've tried to destroy this. They tried to raise the women to have the same kind of mentality as men, and they use all kinds of artificial ways to try to prevent pregnancy or to destroy the child. So therefore, we have everywhere a dharma. But this is the natural, Krishna's natural plan. So then what is the ghee of married life? So that's pretty obvious. The main ghee of married life, of course, is children. And Prabhupada says, soul to soul via the super soul. So one of the main responsibilities of married couples is to produce good population for the planet, to produce children who are conceived and raised with love, who are being trained to be devotees of the Lord, and the earth can hold any number of children who are pious and devotees of the Lord. There's no question of overpopulation if everybody's a devotee of the Lord. You can't have too many saintly persons. You just can't. Saintly persons are not going to put the world out of balance. And another ghee of married life is, again, this emotional love. So when marriage is actually entered into as a sacrifice, then Prabhupada says it makes the mind peaceful. When you have a husband and wife who are happy with each other, who are serving each other to please Krishna, then the whole society becomes very peaceful. It spreads peace and harmony and stability throughout society. And the other ghee of married life is the creation of wealth or good fortune. So that depends on your varna. If you're a brahmana, the way you create good fortune is by increasing knowledge and understanding. If you're a kshatriya, the way you create good fortune is by care of people. If you're a vaishya, by generating actual wealth. If you're a shudra, by generating arts and services and crafts and skills in the society. We should just note briefly that occupations are only for this married lifetime. A student doesn't have a job usually, right? A student is learning for a future job. A student doesn't have a job. A retired person, by definition, doesn't have a job. That's what you retire from. You retire from a job. And sannyas means civil death. Certainly dead people don't have jobs. So students retired and dead people don't have jobs. They don't have occupations. The person who has an occupation is the married person. And again, according to the Varnashram system, if you want an occupation, you get married. You do not have an occupation or a job without being married. At least you take responsibility for your spouse and your children and to give charity to society. This concept that I have a job and a house but I'm not married is definitely not the Vedic ashram system. And one indicator as to whether one is competent to be in the renounced ashrams or whether one should marry is, do I have a desire to contribute to the world in one of these ways, by protecting truth, protecting people, protecting natural resources and animals, or protecting the arts and skills? Do I want to contribute to society in these ways, and do I want to have an income? So this is one of the ghee of the married life. So that's all from Shastra. I'm going to give another analogy that's just Urmila's analogy. So far everything I've presented has been Sadhu Shastra Guru. Now I'm going to present something from Urmila. If you like it, you can take it. If you don't like it, you're free to ignore it. So we all have arms. Everybody here has arms. Yes, arms are good. You like arms? Everybody like arms? Like your arms? Okay. So a broken arm. So just like our original spiritual feelings of love for Krishna, that's like our arm. Our material lust is like a broken arm. What's the cure for a broken arm? A cast, a plaster, right? That's the cure. That's how you cure a broken arm. So this cast, this plaster, that is bhakti. That is transforming our trying to satisfy ourselves selfishly, separately from Krishna, with our trying to please Krishna. But you may know, if you are involved in medicine, that when the body is in severe pain, the muscles of the body become very tense. They become like steel. And that's done for protection. I was in a car accident some years ago, and afterwards I started to have really bad back pain, and when I went to an osteopath, She said, what happened is all the muscles around my spine became like steel to protect my spine. So that's necessary at first, but if the muscles stay very tense, they prevent healing because they start conflicting with blood flow. So if a person has severe pain, they're given a painkiller to relax the muscles and facilitate healing. Now, will painkillers cure your broken arm? No. In fact, if you only take painkillers, they may make it worse because you won't feel the pain of the broken arm and you may injure it further. And you don't take painkillers the whole time you have the cast on. You only take it until the severe pain has subsided. So just like the cast is like bhakti, the painkillers are the ashrams, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas. Those are our painkillers, to be either married or renounced. And just like some people are allergic to different kinds of painkillers, so some people are allergic to the married painkiller, some people are allergic to the renounced painkiller, so you take the proper painkiller that works for you. Okay, but the real cure is bhakti. So that's my own little analogy. And then just to summarize, so this desire for pleasure is part of the soul. That sexual energy and desire are part of the spiritual forms of both Krishna and the living entities. Spiritual sexual satisfaction for the soul is in pleasing Krishna. Therefore, it cannot be killed, and attempts to kill it result in hard-heartedness, anger, fall down, etc. How does love turn into lust? When we misuse our independence, when we try to enjoy Krishna's energy separately from Krishna by stealing it, and then this original desire gets twisted and comes out in the form of a gross body. The real cure is to practice getting our pleasure from uniting Krishna with his pleasure energy by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra with a desire for service and by taxing our brain to serve the mission. And while we are doing that, engaging our sexuality, butter on the fire, making ghee, in the renounced ashram, expanding the family through preaching, and having creative, connecting, pleasure energy in study, meditation, and the mission, or in the married ashram, putting that butter in the pot of marriage, creating children, and offering our occupation and its wealth to the Lord. So this is our very wonderful philosophy of Krishna and his Ladini Shakti. So who else in the world has any wonderful philosophy like this, as taught to us by Srila Prabhupada? Anybody else? Is there anywhere else in the world where we can find such a wonderful philosophy? Right? Most other religions and philosophies, they have no idea what this energy is or how to do with it. So I think we've gone to the limit of our time, and therefore we don't have any time for questions, for which I apologize. Oh, yeah, sorry.